Listen, you're not of the Foundation. You're a native of Calgan, aren't you? Yes. Well, then your knowledge of the Selden plan may be vague. When the First Galactic Empire was falling, Harry Selden and a group of psychohistorians, analyzing the future course of history by mathematical tools no longer available in these degenerate times, set up two foundations, one at each end of the galaxy, in such a way that the economic and sociological forces that were slowly evolving would make them serve as foci for the Second Empire. Harry Selden planned on 1,000 years to accomplish that, and it would have taken 30,000 without the foundations. But he didn't count on me. I am a mutant, and I am unpredictable by psychohistory, which can only deal with the average reactions of numbers. Do you understand? Perfectly, sir. But how does that involve me? You'll understand shortly. I intend to unite the galaxy now, and reach Selden's 1,000-year goal in 300. One foundation, the world of physical scientists, is still flourishing under me. Under the prosperity and order of the Union, the atomic weapons they have developed are capable of dealing with anything in the galaxy, except perhaps the Second Foundation. So I must know more about it. General Pritchard is of the definite opinion that it does not exist at all. I know otherwise. Janice said delicately, "How do you know, sir?" And the mule's words were suddenly liquid indignation. "Because minds under my control have been interfered with, delicately, subtly, but not so subtly that I couldn't notice. And these interferences are increasing, and hitting valuable men at important times. Do you wonder now that a certain discretion has kept me motionless these years? That is your importance. General Pritchard is the best man left me, so he is no longer safe. Of course, he does not know that. But you are unconverted, and therefore not instantly detectable as a mule's man. You may fool the Second Foundation longer than one of my own men would, perhaps just sufficiently longer. Do you understand?" Yes, but pardon me, sir, if I question you. How are these men of yours disturbed, so that I might detect change in General Pritchard in case any occurs? Are they unconverted again? Do they become disloyal? No, I told you it was subtle. It's more disturbing than that, because it's harder to detect, and sometimes I have to wait before acting, uncertain whether a key man is being normally erratic or has been tampered with. Their loyalty is left intact, but initiative and ingenuity are rubbed out. I'm left with a perfectly normal person, apparently, but one completely useless. In the last year, 6 have been so treated. 6 of my best. A corner of his mouth lifted. They're in charge of training bases now, and my most earnest wishes go with them that no emergencies come up for them to decide upon. Suppose, sir, suppose it were not the Second Foundation. What if it were another, such as yourself, another mutant? The planning is too careful, too long range. A single man would be in a greater hurry. No, it is a world, and you are to be my weapon against it. Janice's eyes shone as he said, "I'm delighted at the chance." But the mule caught the sudden emotional upwelling. He said, "Yes, apparently it occurs to you that you will perform a unique service, worthy of a unique reward, perhaps even that of being my successor. Quite so. But there are unique punishments, too, you know. My emotional gymnastics are not confined to the creation of loyalty alone." And the little smile on his thin lips was grim, as Janice leaped out of his seat in horror. For just an instant, just one flashing instant, Janice had felt the pang of an overwhelming grief close over him. It had slammed down with a physical pain that had blackened his mind unbearably, and then lifted. Now nothing was left but the strong wash of anger. The mule said, "Anger won't help. Yes, you're covering it up now, aren't you? But I can see it. So just remember, that sort of business can be made more intense and kept up. I've killed men by emotional control, and there's no death crueler." He paused. "That's all." The mule was alone again. He let the lights die, and the wall before him kicked to transparency again. The sky was black, and the rising body of the galactic lens was spreading its bespanglement across the velvet depths of space. All that haze of nebula was a mass of stars so numerous that they melted one into the other, and left nothing but a cloud of light. And all to be his. and now but one last arrangement to make, and he could sleep. First interlude. The executive council of the Second Foundation was in session. To us, they are merely voices. Neither the exact scene of the meeting nor the identity of those present are essential at the point. Nor, strictly speaking, can we even consider an exact reproduction of any part of the session, unless we wish to sacrifice completely even the minimum comprehensibility we have a right to expect. We deal here with psychologists, and not merely psychologists. Let us say, rather, scientists with a psychological orientation, that is, men whose fundamental conception of scientific philosophy is pointed in an entirely different direction from all of the orientations we know. The psychology of scientists brought up among the axioms deduced from the observational habits of physical science has only the vaguest relationship to psychology, which is about as far as I can go in explaining color to a blind man, with myself as blind as the audience. The point being made is that the minds assembled understood thoroughly the workings of each other, not only by general theory, but by the specific application over a long period of these theories to particular individuals. Speech, as known to us, was unnecessary. A fragment of a sentence amounted almost to long-winded redundancy. A gesture, a grunt, the curve of a facial line, even a significantly timed pause, yielded informational juice. The liberty is taken, therefore, of freely translating a small portion of the conference into the extremely specific word combinations necessary to minds oriented from childhood to a physical science philosophy, even at the risk of losing the more delicate nuances. There was one voice predominant, and that belonged to the individual known simply as the first speaker. He said, "It is apparently quite definite now as to what stopped the mule in his first mad rush. I can't say that the matter reflects credit upon the organization of the situation. Apparently, he almost located us by means of the artificially heightened brain energy of what they call a psychologist on the First Foundation. This psychologist was killed just before he could communicate his discovery to the mule. The events leading to that killing were completely fortuitous for all calculations below Phase 3. Suppose you take over." It was the fifth speaker who was indicated by an inflection of the voice. He said, in grim nuances, "It is certain that the situation was mishandled. We are, of course, highly vulnerable under mass attack, particularly an attack led by such a mental phenomenon as the mule. Shortly after he first achieved galactic eminence with the conquest of the First Foundation, half a year after, to be exact, he was on Trantor. Within another half year, he would have been here, and the odds would have been stupendously against us, 96.3 plus or minus 0.05%, to be exact. We have spent considerable time analyzing the forces that stopped him. We know, of course, what was driving him on so in the first place. The internal ramifications of his physical deformity and mental uniqueness are obvious to all of us. However, it was only through penetration to Phase 3 that we could determine, after the fact, the possibility of his anomalous action in the presence of another human being who had an honest affection for him. And since such an anomalous action would depend upon the presence of such another human being at the appropriate time, to that extent the whole affair was fortuitous. Our agents are certain that it was a girl that killed the mule psychologist, a girl for whom the mule felt trust out of sentiment, and whom he, therefore, did not control mentally, simply because she liked him. Since that event, and for those who want the details, a mathematical treatment of the subject has been drawn up for the Central Library, which warned us, we have held the mule off by unorthodox methods, with which we daily risk Selden's entire scheme of history. That is all." The first speaker paused an instant to allow the individuals assembled to absorb the full implications. He said, "The situation is then highly unstable. With Selden's original scheme bent to the fracture point, and I must emphasize that we have blundered badly in this whole matter, in our horrible lack of foresight, we are faced with an irreversible breakdown of the plan. Time is passing us by. I think there is only one solution left us, and even that is risky. We must allow the mule to find us, in a sense." Another pause, in which he gathered the reactions. Then, "I repeat, in a sense." Chapter 2. Two men without the mule. The ship was in near readiness. Nothing lacked but the destination. The mule had suggested a return to Trantor, the world that was the hulk of an incomparable galactic metropolis, of the hugest empire mankind had ever known. The dead world that had been capital of all the stars. Pritchard disapproved. It was an old path, sucked dry. He found Bail Channis in the ship's navigation room. The young man's curly hair was just sufficiently disheveled to allow a single curl to droop over the forehead, as if it had been carefully placed there, and even teeth showed in a smile that matched it. Vaguely, the stiff officer felt himself hardened against the other. Channis's excitement was evident. Pritchard, it's too far a coincidence, the general said coldly. I'm not aware of the subject of conversation. Oh, well then drag up a chair, old man, and let's get into it. I've been going over your notes. I find them excellent. How pleasant that you do. But I'm wondering if you've come to the conclusions I have. Have you ever tried analyzing the problem deductively? I mean, it's all very well to comb the stars at random, and to have done all you did in 5 expeditions is quite a bit of star hopping. That's obvious. But have you calculated how long it would take to go through every known world at this rate? Yes, several times. Pritchard felt no need to meet the young man halfway, but there was the importance of filching the other's mind, the other's uncontrolled and hence unpredictable mind. Well then, suppose we're analytical about it and try to decide just what we're looking for. The second foundation, said Pritchard grimly. A foundation of psychologists, corrected Channis, who are as weak in physical science as the first foundation was weak in psychology. Well, you're from the first foundation, which I'm not. The implications are probably obvious to you. We must find a world which rules by virtue of mental skills, and yet which is very backward scientifically. Is that necessarily so? Questioned Pritchard quietly. Our own union of worlds isn't backward scientifically, even though our ruler owes his strength to his mental powers. Because he has the skills of the first foundation to draw upon, came the slightly impatient answer. And that is the only such reservoir of knowledge in the galaxy. The second foundation must live among the dry crumbs of the broken galactic empire. There are no pickings there. So then you postulate mental power sufficient to establish their rule over a group of worlds, and physical helplessness as well? Comparative physical helplessness. Against the decadent neighboring areas, they are competent to defend themselves. Against the resurgent forces of the mule, with his background of a mature atomic economy, they cannot stand. Else, why is their location so well hidden, both at the start by the founder Harry Seldon, and now by themselves? Your own first foundation made no secret of its existence, and did not have it made for them, when they were an undefended single city on a lonely planet 300 years ago. The smooth lines of Pritchard's dark face twitched sardonically. And now that you've finished your deep analysis, would you like a list of all the kingdoms, republics, planet states, and dictatorships of one sort or another in that political wilderness out there that correspond to your description and to several factors besides? All this has been considered, then. Channis lost none of his brashness. You won't find it here, naturally. But we have a completely worked-out guide to the political units of the opposing periphery. Really, did you suppose the mule would work entirely hit and miss? Well then, and the young man's voice rose in a burst of energy. What about the oligarchy of Tazenda? Pritchard touched his ear thoughtfully. Tazenda. Oh, I think I know it. They're not in the periphery, are they? Seems to me they're fully a third of the way towards the center of the galaxy. Yes, what of that? The records we have place the second foundation at the other end of the galaxy. Space knows it's the only thing we have to go on. Why talk of Tazenda anyway? Its angular deviation from the first foundation radian is only about 110 to 120 degrees anyway. Nowhere near 180. There's another point in the records. The second foundation was established at Star's End. No such region in the galaxy has ever been located, because it was a local name, suppressed later for greater secrecy, or maybe one invented for the purpose by Seldon and his group. Yet there's some relationship between Star's End and Tazenda, don't you think? A vague similarity in sound? Insufficient. Have you ever been there? No. Yet it is mentioned in your records. Where? Oh, yes. But that was merely to take on food and water. There was certainly nothing remarkable about the world. Did you land at the ruling planet, the center of government? I couldn't possibly say. Janice brooded about it under the other's cold gaze. Then, would you look at the lens with me for a moment? Certainly. The lens was perhaps the newest feature of the interstellar cruisers of the day. Actually, it was a complicated calculating machine, which could throw on a screen a reproduction of the night sky, as seen from any given point of the galaxy. Janice adjusted the coordinate points, and the wall lights of the pilot room were extinguished. In the dim red light at the control board of the lens, Janice's face glowed ruddily. Pritcher sat in the pilot seat, long legs crossed, face lost in the gloom. Slowly, as the induction period passed, the points of light brightened on the screen. And then they were thick and bright with the generously populated star groupings of the galaxy's center. This, explained Janice, is the winter night sky as seen from Trantor. That is the important point that, as far as I know, has been neglected so far in your search. All intelligent orientation must start from Trantor as zero point. Trantor was the capital of the Galactic Empire, even more so scientifically and culturally than politically. And therefore, the significance of any descriptive name should stem, 9 times out of 10, from a Trantorian orientation. You'll remember in this connection that, although Selden was from Helicon, towards the periphery, his group worked on Trantor itself. What is it you're trying to show me? Pritchard's level voice plunged icily into the gathering enthusiasm of the other. The map will explain it. Do you see the dark nebula? The shadow of his arm fell upon the screen, which took on the bespanglement of the galaxy. The pointing finger ended on a tiny patch of black that seemed a hole in the speckled fabric of light. The stellographical records call it Pellet's Nebula. Watch it. I'm going to expand the image. Pritcher had watched the phenomenon of lens image expansion before, but he still caught his breath. It was like being at the visiplate of a spaceship storming through a horribly crowded galaxy without entering hyperspace. The stars diverged towards them from a common center, flared outwards, and tumbled off the edge of the screen. Single points became double, then globular. Hazy patches dissolved into myriad points. And always that illusion of motion. Janice spoke through it all. You'll notice that we are moving along the direct line from Trantor to Pellet's Nebula, so that in effect we are still looking at a stellar orientation equivalent to that of Trantor. There is probably a slight error because of the gravitic deviation of light that I haven't the math to calculate for, but I'm sure it can't be significant. The darkness was spreading over the screen. As the rate of magnification slowed, the stars slipped off the four ends of the screen in a regretful leave-taking. At the rims of the growing nebula, the brilliant universe of stars shone abruptly, in token for that light which was merely hidden behind the swirling, unradiating atom fragments of sodium and calcium that filled cubic parsecs of space. And Janice pointed again. This has been called the mouth by the inhabitants of that region of space, and that is significant because it is only from the Trantorian orientation that it looks like a mouth. What he indicated was a rift in the body of the nebula, shaped like a ragged, grinning mouth in profile, outlined by the glazing glory of the starlight with which it was filled. Follow the mouth, said Janice. Follow the mouth towards the gullet as it narrows down to a thin, splintering line of light. Again the screen expanded a trifle, until the nebula stretched away from the mouth to block off all the screen but that narrow trickle, and Janice's fingers silently followed it down to where it straggled to a halt. And then, as his finger continued moving onward, to a spot where one single star sparked lonesomely. And there his finger halted, for beyond that was blackness, unrelieved. Star's end, said the young man simply. The fabric of the nebula is thin there, and the light of that one star finds its way through in just that one direction, to shine on Trantor. You're trying to tell me that... The voice of the mule's general died in suspicion. I'm not trying. That is Tazenda. Star's end. The lights went on. The lens flicked off. Pritcher reached Janice in three long strides. What made you think of this? And Janice leaned back in his chair with a queerly puzzled expression on his face. It was accidental. I'd like to take intellectual credit for this, but it was only accidental. In any case, however it happens, it fits. According to our references, Tazenda is an oligarchy. It rules 27 inhabited planets. It is not advanced scientifically. And most of all, it is an obscure world that has adhered to a strict neutrality in the local politics of that stellar region, and is not expansionist. I think we ought to see it. Have you informed the Mule of this? No, nor shall we. We're in space now, about to make the first hop. Pritcher, in sudden horror, sprang to the visiplate. Cold space met his eyes when he adjusted it. He gazed fixedly at the view, then turned. Automatically, his hand reached for the hard, comfortable curve of the butt of his blaster. By whose order? By my order, General. It was the first time Channis had ever used the other's title. While I was engaging you here, you probably felt no acceleration, because it came at the moment I was expanding the field of the lens, and you undoubtedly imagined it to be an illusion of the apparent star motion. Why? Just what are you doing? What was the point of your nonsense about Tazenda, then? That was no nonsense. I was completely serious. We're going there. We left today because we were scheduled to leave 3 days from now. General, you don't believe there is a second foundation, and I do. You are merely following the Mule's orders without faith. I recognize a serious danger. The second foundation has now had 5 years to prepare. How they've prepared, I don't know. But what if they have agents on Calgan? If I carry about in my mind the knowledge of the whereabouts of the second foundation, they may discover that. My life might no longer be safe, and I have a great affection for my life. Even on a thin and remote possibility such as that, I would rather play safe. No one knows of Tazenda but you, and you found out only after we were out in space. And even so, there is the question of the crew. Janice was smiling again, ironically, in obviously complete control of the situation. Pritchard's hand fell away from his blaster, and for a moment a vague discomfort pierced him. What kept him from action? What deadened him? There was a time when he was a rebellious and unpromoted captain of the First Foundation's commercial empire, when it would have been himself rather than Channis who would have taken prompt and daring action such as that. Was the Mule right? Was his controlled mind so concerned with obedience as to lose initiative? He felt a thickening despondency drive him down into a strange lassitude. He said, "Well done. However, you will consult me in the future before making decisions of this nature." The flickering signal caught his attention. "That's the engine room," said Channis, casually. "They warmed up on 5 minutes' notice, and I asked them to let me know if there was any trouble. Want to hold the fort?" Pritchard nodded mutely, and cogitated in the sudden loneliness on the evils of approaching 50. The visiplate was sparsely starred. The main body of the galaxy missed at one end. What if he were free of the Mule's influence? But he recoiled in horror at the thought. Chief Engineer Huxlani looked sharply at the young, ununiformed man, who carried himself with the assurance of a fleet officer and seemed to be in a position of authority. Huxlani, as a regular fleet man from the days his chin had dripped milk, generally confused authority with specific insignia. But the Mule had appointed this man, and the Mule was, of course, the last word. The only word, for that matter. Not even subconsciously did he question that. Emotional control went deep. He handed Channis the little oval object without a word. Channis hefted it and smiled engagingly. "You're a Foundation man, aren't you, Chief?"
"Yes, sir. I served in the Foundation fleet 18 years before the First Citizen took over."
"Foundation training in engineering?"
"Qualified technician, first class. Central school on Anacreon."
"Good enough. And you found this on the communication circuit, where I asked you to look?"
"Yes, sir."
"Does it belong there?"
"No, sir."
"Then what is it?"
"A hypertracer, sir."
"No, that's not enough. I'm not a Foundation man. What is it?"
"It's a device to allow the ship to be traced through hyperspace.
In other words, we can be followed anywhere."
"Yes, sir."
"All right. It's a recent invention, isn't it? It was developed by one of the research institutes set up by the First Citizen, wasn't it?"
"I believe so, sir."
"And its workings are a government secret, right?"
"I believe so, sir."
"Yet here it is." "Intriguing." Channis tossed the hypertracer methodically from hand to hand for a few seconds. Then sharply, he held it out. "Take it, then, and put it back exactly where you found it, and exactly how you found it. Understand? And then forget this incident. Entirely." The chief choked down his near-automatic salute, turned sharply, and left. The ship bounded through the galaxy, its path a wide space dotted line through the stars. The dots referred to were the scant stretches of 10 to 60 light seconds spent in normal space, and between them stretched the 100 and up light year gaps that represented the hops through hyperspace. Bail Chanis sat at the control panel of the lens and felt again the involuntary surge of near worship at the contemplation of it. He was not a Foundation man, and the interplay of forces at the twist of a knob or the breaking of a contact was not second nature to him. Not that the lens ought quite to bore even a Foundation man. Within its unbelievably compact body were enough electronic circuits to pinpoint accurately 100 million separate stars in exact relationship to each other. And as if that were not a feat in itself, it was further capable of translating any given portion of the galactic field along any of the three spatial axes, or to rotate any portion of the field about a center. It was because of that that the lens had performed a near revolution in interstellar travel. In the younger days of interstellar travel, the calculation of each hop through hyperspace meant any amount of work from a day to a week, and a larger portion of such work was the more or less precise calculation of ship's position on the galactic scale of reference. Essentially, that meant the accurate observation of at least three widely spaced stars, the position of which, with reference to the arbitrary galactic 000, were known. And it is the word known that is the catch. To any who know the star field well from one certain reference point, stars are as individual as people. Jump 10 parsecs, however, and not even your own sun is recognizable. It may not even be visible. The answer was, of course, spectroscopic analysis. For centuries, the main object of interstellar engineering was the analysis of the light signature of more and more stars in greater and greater detail. With this, and the growing precision of the hop itself, standard routes of travel through the galaxy were adopted, and interstellar travel became less of an art and more of a science. And yet, even under the Foundation, with improved calculating machines and a new method of mechanically scanning the star field for a known light signature, it sometimes took days to locate three stars and then calculate position in regions not previously familiar to the pilot. It was the lens that changed all that. For one thing, it required only a single known star. For another, even a space tyro such as Chanis could operate it. The nearest sizable star at the moment was Vincetori, according to hop calculations, and on the visiplate now, a bright star was centered. Chanis hoped that it was Vincetori. The field screen of the lens was thrown directly next that of the visiplate, and with careful fingers, Chanis punched out the coordinates of Vincetori. He closed a relay, and the star field sprang to bright view. In it, too, a bright star was centered, but otherwise there seemed no relationship. He adjusted the lens along the Z-axis and expanded the field to where the photometer showed both centered stars to be of equal brightness. Chanis looked for a second star, sizably bright, on the visiplate, and found one on the field screen to correspond. Slowly he rotated the screen to similar angular deflection. He twisted his mouth and rejected the result with a grimace. Again he rotated, and another bright star was brought into position, and a third. And then he grinned. That did it. Perhaps a specialist with trained relationship perception might have clicked first try, but he'd settled for three. That was the adjustment. In the final step, the two fields overlapped and merged into a sea of not quite rightness. Most of the stars were close doubles, but the fine adjustment did not take long. The double stars melted together, one field remained, and the ship's position could now be read directly off the dials. The entire procedure had taken less than half an hour. Chanis found Han Pritcher in his private quarters. The general was quite apparently preparing for bed. He looked up. This book is continued on cassette number 2.